Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
My name is Martin. I'm 84 years old. People think I'm crazy when I tell them how old I am. I'd like to be normal. I just have a sickness. The only way I can survive is by drinking blood. You see, people don't understand what's wrong. They think that I'm a monster. They think I'm a vampire.
Martin, another kind of terror.
I would like to be like everyone else. I have to do things that I don't necessarily like to do. But I want to stay alive. I do need blood.
From the director of Night of the Living Dead.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
You know, if I was an 84-year-old vampire, I'd find a retirement village somewhere, and I certainly wouldn't be hanging out in Pittsburgh.
And we're also joined this week by Professor of Literature and Horror at LaSalle University, Edward G. Pettit.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
This week we're talking about Martin, the 1976 film from George A. Romero. Martin is the story of an awkward man who comes to Pittsburgh after the recent death of a relative. He moves in with his cousin Cuda, an old man steeped in an old world lore. Is he just severely outmoded, or is there something more to Martin? Is Martin just a stalkerish weirdo who likes to drink blood? Does he have a rare medical condition, or is he simply an 84-year-old vampire? So, Ed, as our guest this week, I want to ask you about your history with Martin. When did you first see it, and what makes it stand out for you?
Well, first, Mike, I like your intro and how you make it sound almost as if this zany, offbeat comedy. This poor, misunderstood kid, is he really a vampire, or does he just like blood? I was introduced to this by actually a professor when I was in college in the late 80s at LaSalle University, where they allow me to teach now, which is nice. He was a really kind of offbeat professor, and he kind of became my mentor. And I, at one point, he gave me a list, which I have. Oh, boy, I should have dug that out. I have somewhere the list of films he gave me. It's about 15 or 20 films. And they were all strange films, like Martin, a strange vampire film, and things like, I think Tough Guys Don't Dance was on there, an odd movie people usually don't see. And it was a whole list of stuff like that, and said, here, you want to see some, you know, really good movies, watch these. Obviously, Martin, I just, you know, fell in love with right away. To this day, it's still the strangest vampire movie I've ever seen, I think.
I think I saw Martin because I went through and I needed to be a completist about George A. Romero films. I had loved Dawn of the Dead, still do, and went back and saw a whole bunch of other of his work, and eventually you end up landing on Martin, although it was at the time not as accessible and easy to get as it is today.
Is it even available as a good DVD nowadays? Because the last I recall, the one DVD that was out of it that was available was even kind of cropped. And I'm not even sure if there's even a I found a version online that I downloaded illegally. That's really complete, but I heard that the old VHS ones were actually the best copies of this movie.
Yeah, it was the old VHS ones, or what I remember back in the 90s were the ones that I saw, and it was, I think it may have been Anchor Bay or somebody that put them out, or even like a lower level company of Anchor Bay, and I just remember this sort of like odd color photo on the front that you have of John Amplis as Martin, and he's got like the razor in his mouth or something.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a psychedelic looking cover. It really didn't give you any information as to what the hell was going on the tape, but that was the one I saw.
I picked that one up forever ago at a video store that was going out of business, and it wasn't Anchor Bay that was putting it out. I want to say it was like Vestron or something, and it was just the razor blade with the vampire teeth and no picture of a person on the front cover. And it took me, of course, I don't know when that video store was going out of business, probably about 10 years or so ago. And then I finally watched it for the first time like 2 weeks ago. So it took me a little while to watch it, but I appreciate you pushing me to watch this one, Rob.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, for me, I wanted to see this movie for all the reasons, as Ed says. You know, it's just this odd little vampire movie, and it can lead you into places that you didn't expect, especially when it comes to other vampire films or even George Romero's whole filmography.
It is, especially with vampire movies. I mean, there are other subversive vampire movies, but this one is doesn't only play with the concept of vampire, but it directly addresses vampire films and what we expect from them. And I find that fascinating to watch. In a way, I was just thinking this recently when I just rewatched it. It's like the anti-Twilight 30 years before Twilight, you know, was written, it seems to me.
I like that there's the mystery to me. I mean, the reason why I did the intro the way that I did it was just because, I mean, you could watch the movie and say, okay, this guy is really super influenced by vampire movies and he's not really a vampire, you know, and all of those scenes that you see of him kind of reenacting things in black and white, maybe they're not actually his past, but they're the way that he sees things, the way that he imagines himself to be like a hero in a vampire film. And, you know, it's very romantic. His hair is shorter. He looks better. And, you know, I think you almost see like villagers with pitchforks at one point.
You do. Yeah.
And he talks, you know, constantly like, oh, in movies they do this and movies have it all wrong.
That's not like in the movies either. I saw a movie once where it happened every night. Now that's crazy. Those movies are crazy.
Oh, so you mean to tell me all those movies are true, huh?
Maybe he's not what he says that he is, and maybe he's sincerely motivated by films. I don't know. You know, it's an interesting take on it. When I was watching this film with the director's commentary, which was Romero, Savini, and Amplis, listening to them talk about it, they really kind of posited it as Martin is just influenced by movies. Whereas in the screenplay, it seems like, no, he really is 84 years old and he really is this guy who's not necessarily a supernatural vampire, but he's definitely has this sickness and has been around for all these years and does have this true history.
Well, the one thing for me when I watch it and I look at it, especially when you can look at those black and white sequences and things like that, is to me the whole film seems to be talking about the difference between the fantasy and the mundane day-to-day life. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about him stalking the woman in the beginning and she's in this flowing gown and then he gets there and she's in a mud mask and really not as attractive as when he really saw her. But it, like, the whole film seems to be about how the ideas in our head, maybe like how we fantasize things will be or how we would like things to be versus sort of the mundane life. And then the whole film is sort of shot almost documentary style at times. It's no real high gloss. We get this working class Pittsburgh. It's very mundane day-to-day life. And then also at one point it brings in the reality of the times, because Tom Savini's character is complaining about lack of work, which must have been around the time when the steel industry wasn't doing all that well.
Every time it looks like he's going to go in for like the romantic kill kind of thing and have that kind of, Bram Stoker kind of, you know, atmosphere and things, he goes in and yeah, she's wearing the mud mask and he's totally turned off by that. Or he goes in to attack another woman and there's another guy there. And it's just like, oh, everything goes wrong for this dude. Even though he says he's so careful about stuff, still nothing seems to go right for him.
He doesn't.
Whatsoever.
He's always trying to do the sexy stuff without the blood or with the blood, and he doesn't get to do it. It's always knocked away from him. And he says over and over in the film, he says on more than one occasion,
I'm a vampire!
Romero is, if anything, not subtle. But that's okay. I always like that Romero's never going to be subtle. He's just like, this is what I'm filming. This is the message that I'm giving you, and like it or not. And he's constantly, Martin's constantly in the film saying, there's no magic. You know, there is no magic. That it seems to me that, for me, it's a vampire movie because Martin believes he's a vampire, and the vampire hunter believes he's a vampire. And Martin explains it. Martin pretty much says, yes, I'm a vampire, but what you all don't know is there's no, besides the fact that I've lived a long time, vampires don't have any special powers. So for me, it winds up being it's a kind of like that's the kind of vampire he is, just like other vampires, you know, define their rules. I like that Romero winds up defining his rules and recognizes that this vampire is just like a serial killer would be, you know, or something. This is made right after the Manson murders, right after the help of that big L.A. one, the other L.A. one, too. But so this is a time when, especially that 1970s after the Manson murders, I mean, everybody's thinking about serial killers.
That was the thing that I was put in my notes is, you know, this whole thing with him knocking out the women with sedative and then using a razor blade to get the blood. And like you were saying, I mean, either he's not a real vampire or because he does that, he's the most real vampire there is. It's sort of this conundrum two-way idea on him. And the horror in the film, to me, isn't really from the blood. It really isn't from all of that and being the vampire. That home invasion scene, which Mike alluded to, where he wants to attack this woman in her home and finds out that her boyfriend's there, I mean, that's a truly scary scene. And it's so scary because of, like I said, the mundane realness of the staging and the attacking. It's very clumsy at times, the way that people react to having someone in their house. Should we call the cops? Should we not call the cops? I mean, that home invasion scene is probably one of the more scary scenes I've seen in this film and in several films.
It is. It really works. And even the opening scene on the train where he kills the woman, I think the fight, the struggle with her is a little too drawn out. But especially when it's over and then he cuts her and he undresses her and he's lying with her. I had to, when I showed this film for my class last semester, and it's really hard watching that opening scene with like 20... 19-year-old girls in the class, you know, as my students. I so felt like a creepy old man showing them this scene and trying to explain, you know, it didn't talk about it and all that. And they were shocked by it. My students were really put off by this movie. Some of them hated it. They hated it because it made them really uncomfortable all the way through.
The film has a really interesting look, and I was fascinated to hear that Romero shot this all on reversal film. He didn't shoot it on negative stock. And it's got that kind of, at least I don't know about the print that you guys watch, but the one that I saw was really kind of like almost pink, but not quite. And just the colors all looked kind of off. I mean, the black and white stuff looked gorgeous, and at one point Romero actually wanted to shoot the whole thing in black and white, but I think the use of the black and white just for those kind of fantasy scenes is actually better. But yeah, it looks really kind of rough around the edges for me. It hasn't aged well as far as the look of the film.
Well, that whole use of reversal would also add itself to being documentary because, I mean, TV at the time was, especially TV news, was shot on reversal because it was a quick turnaround, so... For those who don't know film technology, reversal is basically it goes into the camera, it's recorded as a negative, and through chemical process comes out a positive, and that's what you can actually project is that image that you have.
Right, so you don't have a negative from which prints are struck. You basically have like your one print, and then if you want to make copies of it, the quality degrades significantly as far as I know.
The other well-known films that were shot on reversal, probably in the same era, maybe a few years earlier, is John Waters' Pink Flamingos. So if you're looking for sort of a visual corollary, you might want to look there too.
Yeah, and it was definitely a lot cheaper. I mean, you could buy it from, you know, the same places where they sold news footage, that kind of stuff. You could buy it from there. And it, because there wasn't a print or a negative, it was a lot cheaper and everything. So it's interesting to me that there was a different print of this film, you know, and the commentary is hilarious because throughout the entire commentary, Romero just keeps talking about this longer print of the movie and just keeps bemoaning it the whole time. Just like, oh, there was this longer print and I don't know what happened to it. Remember when we watched it in my office and all this kind of stuff. And it's just like over and over and just like, please, if you're listening to this and you have a copy of that print, please bring it back. Let me know, you know, show it someplace. I want to know. I just want to see it again.
And it sounds like because of that process, that's why he's lost it. I mean, he had this, 2-hour, 45-minute version of it, and because I guess there's no just original negative that he had to cut it up, and who knows where it went. I'm glad it's gone. I mean, I would love to see all that extra stuff, but I like how tight this movie is at an hour and a half. And I do know in the original, and even the, you get some of it. No, do you get some of it in the script?
A little bit of it.
You get a little bit of it, and you get a little bit in the novelization. I actually have the novelization of this.
I want to read the novelization just because the script...
Some of the novelization is verbatim from the script.
Yeah, and the script is just so descriptive of everything, and there's just so much more to it. I mean, I actually wanted to read just a little bit of it. I mean, there's a part where Martin is in the car with Mrs. DeLemus, the woman who he eventually ends up doing the sexy stuff with. And
Santini, I think that's her name.
In the script. I know a lot of names changed in the script, because I know even Kuda's name was different. It was like Taji Koda or something. But yeah, in the movie, he... At one point, she asks him to open up the glove compartment, and he just pops it open and hesitates for a second and then hands her whatever she wanted from the glove compartment. And in the script, there's this whole description about Martin stares into the glove compartment. There's a little pill bottle and a plastic tube of suntan lotion. There is a pantyhose egg, private parts. The woman suddenly reaches past Martin to flop the notebook back into the compartment. Her closeness for that brief instant makes the young man tighten. He looks at her. She leans back and smiles. You know, it's like so much more than you get in that one little scene.
That's actually the writing in the novelization.
Yeah, I can see the novelization just being like a little bit more.
There's also an afterword in here by Romero where he pretty much just tells you what the movie's about. But it's really great. I mean, it's, you know... I mean, there's nothing, you know, earth-shattering in it, you know. I mean, you get it by watching the movie. I'll actually email you some of the quotes that I had printed out, typed up for my students, just so you have this kind of, just because it's interesting to have. I mean, you know, he talks about, you know, Martin as a monster and an scapegoat and how, you know, we're all kind of extensions of these monsters and, you know, all the stuff that all his movies are about. You know, that's one of the things I love about Romero's movies, is that I don't have to worry about what they're going to be about at heart. I could just watch them because all his movies are about we are the monsters. All except, I think, Knight Riders, which is my favorite Romero movie. Knight Riders I love because it's the opposite. Knight Riders is about we're all the hero. We all have the hero in us that we can bring out. And all of his other movies are we're all monsters. And this is how we're all monsters. And yet he goes in to show that.
Even There's Always Vanilla?
No, I've never seen that. I haven't seen those two, because other two of them, you know, Season of the Witch either. But I guess the vanilla one wouldn't work because, you know, I don't know. I haven't seen it.
It's funny that you say that since he directed a documentary about O.J. Simpson.
An O.J. documentary, I know. I'd love to see that. So I'd have to make a new one.
The thing that's interesting to me is, you know, he was talking about this long cut of the film. And especially when we talk about Dawn of the Dead, there's like, four different versions. I mean, if you want to include the Argento, various Argento cuts. And I kind of agree with you on Martin. It's like, what I really want to see another hour and 20 minutes. There might be some interesting scenes in there, but I think Romero at times gets too interested in his films and he kind of loses track of the viewer and we end up getting our asses really numb because he loves to put everything in there and then it takes other people to cut him back sometimes. Speaking of Martin, another edit of it, from my understanding is there, of course, is now an Italian edit. I don't know if Martin went over there as part of the deal with Dawn of the Dead, but to my understanding, there's a dubbed Italian version, which does feature goblin music. So that might be interesting to see.
That's interesting because I really like the score for this one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The music in this one is fine on its own, but I'm just a huge goblin fan, as you know, from Deep Red episode and all the other stuff we did.
Romero is an interesting director. I mean, just you never know really what, well, up until the last few movies, you never really knew what you were going to get with him. I mean, just the difference between like A Monkey Shines and A Day of the Dead and A Creep Show. I mean, just really so many, you know, it's all within the horror genre, but it's all so different. I mean, even the production values are so different between some of those. And it's just like, all right, you know, and it's nice to see, especially these beginning ones, you know, like to see the Crazies versus Night of the Living Dead versus Dawn of the Dead and Martin. I mean, just those four films, so different between all of them. I mean, to Ed's point, I mean, they really do speak to this whole we are the monster kind of thing. But really, I mean, just the look of them, the way that they're put together, you know, just really such a different look and feel for these films. And I was really glad that he was really kind of doing different things in his early part of his career before he just kind of said, you know what, screw it, I'm just going to make zombie movies for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things I like about him is that he strikes me as a true auteur in that he really does what he wants. He's like, I just want to make this movie and do it in this way. And I get the idea that he's always putting on the screen exactly what he wanted. And sometimes I don't love it, but that's okay. I feel like I'm watching something that he made, and I particularly enjoy that. I was going to say, one of the things that I noticed on this watch is how well I think it's put together as this short hour and a half film is the whole ending and how quickly he gets everything in and so much happens. For that whole movie ending, we get from Martin going out and attacking the winos and then running from the cops and then that drug deal that he stumbles upon, and there's flashbacks interspersed, and then you get these other two winos on toilets while he's cleaning up, while Martin's cleaning up from the murder, and then you get him talking on the radio, you get him and Cuda visiting a poultry butcher and butchering chickens. Then you get Abby's suicide, then you get more radio talk, and then you get that parade that he walks out in, and then he gets staked, and all that, 10 minutes, the last 10 minutes of the movie, Romero puts all that in, and I never felt like it was rushed. It's just, and in my memory, it was never like some rushed ending. It was all that, and he managed to edit it all into 10 minutes, and I thought it worked really well.
Yeah, there really isn't a whole lot other than some of those descriptions that I was talking about that are in the script that I don't see on screen. I mean, there's a little bit more with the ending with Cuda and the police coming and talking to him and saying that somebody had called into the radio show and, you know, was talking about Martin. And then it's almost like Cuda. I don't know if you got this impression when you read the script in the book.
It just, I did, guys.
It feels like Cuda wants to now listen to the radio and see if he can find out who this person was, because he wants to go and kill them,
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
Good. I'm glad I wasn't alone on that one.
it made Cuda a lot more creepy, if that's possible, you know, after staking his young cousin. It made him more creepy than he actually was in the movie. And how about the staking scene? I mean, is this the very first time you watched it too, Mike?
Yeah, first time just 2 weeks ago.
How shocking was that? Did you see that coming?
I did not, and I was, but yeah, it was very satisfying. I mean, it really, you know, he told him, and it's like, you know, I warned you if you do this.
Yeah.
And I was, yeah, it was very satisfying. I liked the amount of gore and everything, and I liked the way that they filmed it. And yeah, it did take me by surprise. I was kind of thinking like, okay, you know, things are going bad again for Martin, but, you know, he's going to keep on keeping on, but yeah, that was interesting.
It almost seems as if, as soon as he stakes him, and then Martin opens his eyes and looks in the blood, it almost seems like this is a nightmare sequence, and then Martin's going to wake up, and then, sure enough, then the next shot is him dead on the bed, and you realize, oh, it's not. But I love how shocking it is, but then as soon as you think about the movie, it's like, oh, well, yeah, he told him he was going to kill him. So, you know, I mean, he's been telling that the whole movie, and obviously, and of course the irony is that he kills him for murdering a woman that he didn't murder, that she just committed suicide.
The thing that I always like throughout the whole film, and maybe this is because of my own family back and forth, is that the film seems to be, is he really a vampire, or does his family in some way make him that way? Like, is it a bunch of crazy people pushing him towards the expectation they have of him?
Well, I like how you can give both readings, that you can read the movie that way, that the family says he is, and but they're crazy, and now he's just crazy. But you can really watch this several times, and it doesn't stumble in that a valid reading is that he is an 84-year-old vampire that really doesn't have any powers besides longevity. But and what I especially, but of course, doing all the Poe stuff, the Edgar Allan Poe stuff that I do, I love that, because that's the kind of thing that Poe does sometimes in his story, that he gives you this realistic reading you could do, and also you could say, well, actually, you know, this could actually be supernatural. This could be an actual supernatural black cat coming back to seek revenge. It doesn't have to, and there's no easy answer there. You can argue both sides, and I like that.
All right, we're going to take a break and play back an interview Rob did with Mike Mayo, author of The Horror Show Guide.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
Here are just a few of the things famous people say about the After Movie Diner podcast.
Hello, I'm Dame Judi Dench, and when I'm not dusting the submarine, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast. You know, for the film reviews.
Hello, I'm Eric Stoltz, and when I'm not taking Uncle to the pictures, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the interviews.
Hello, I'm Lewis Gossett Jr., and when I'm not trampolining for peace, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the music.
Hello, Bernie Taupin here, and when I'm not undermining Venezuela, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the guests.
Hello, I'm Celia Imrie Stunt Double, and when I'm not wanking for tumours, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast for the comedy.
Hi there, I'm Ali Sheedy, and when I'm not taking photographs of bricks, I'm listening to the After Movie Diner podcast, mostly for the pancakes.
Yes, that's right. The award-winning After Movie Diner podcast is all things to all people. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TalkShoe, Podbean, Facebook, Twitter, and at www.aftermoviediner.com.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. K.A.B.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents, and you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know, it's messed up, right?
I have written several books about film. Started way back in the 90s with Video Hounds video premieres. After that, I did Video Hounds Horror Show, and we've just done a second volume of that called The Horror Show Guide. And it essentially is 1,000 short reviews of what I think are the most important, the craziest, the silliest, screwiest horror movies from the days of the silence until 2012. We took the what I think were the best reviews, the most important reviews from the first book, which turned out to be about 500 or so, and then added another 500 or so, picking up the things from the 50s that we'd missed in the first book and the things that had been made since 98 when I wrote the first book, and tried to make something that is a bit more comprehensive, really focused very closely on horror, and is sort of a snapshot of what the genre is, good, bad, and otherwise, from the beginnings of the movie business until now.
You know, that was the thing I was going to say, is I remember when the first edition came out, I went to the book signing at Thomas Video here in Detroit, and I think that must have been right after the Civil War ended. It feels like so long
ago. It was such a different time then. I mean, there was no DVD. The independent video stores were kind of at their peak. We were just starting to see Blockbuster and things getting more important and taking over the business. But if you had a good video store in your neighborhood, you could go there and find the craziest stuff. And that's what I was hoping to celebrate a bit in the book. Since then, it's just a completely different world. To write this book, I actually watched a couple of movies on my device, a little, you know, thing that I held in my hand and actually watched a movie on. That was just completely beyond my imagination in any regard back when I wrote the first book.
Now, if you're playing the movie on a telephone, you will never in a trillion years experience the film. You'll think you have experienced it, but you'll be cheated. It's such a sadness that you think you've seen a film on your effing telephone. Get real.
Yes, yeah, and that is so ridiculous. And the movie that I watched on my device, because it was the only way I could find it, I realized as I was watching it that this is a movie that I'm impressed by. I can see how good it is. But if I were seeing this in a theater, it would just be knocking me right out of my seats. And it's a fairly, not really obscure, but a French film called Frontiers that is just really bizarre and hard to describe. And if I had seen that in a theater with a good crowd, it would have been a completely different experience to me.
You know, going back over the old reviews, you know, going from the first edition to the new one, you know, I was wondering, have you go back and change your mind, or are you kind of like Roger Ebert on Blue Velvet, where it's like it's never going to change?
Right. Well, I did not change anything that was reflecting my opinion at the time. I didn't change. What I did change or tried to reference was the changes in, say, a really murky VHS tape that I saw back in the 90s with a new DVD edition that has really been cleaned up and maybe is 10 minutes longer than the version I saw. I really tried to go and do the research and find out where those were available. And I also tried to note the things that aren't on DVD, that if you want to see them, you're going to have to go and dig up an old VHS tape to see any kind of version of this at all. And for some of the more obscure things, some of which are deliberately obscure or should be, and some of which aren't, they're just really hard to find. You got to dig around on eBay if you want to find a copy anywhere.
You know, you've written several different books reviewing sort of genres. You did a war book, you did, you know, video premieres and things like that. And then, of course, the Horror Show Guide. What is it about horror movies? What do you think that they sort of talk to us and tell us that maybe other genres speak to different things? But what is it about horror films?
I think most horror films, and this has been really reinforced since I wrote the first book, horror films are aimed at young people. They really are almost always stories of initiation. So many horror films can be, the plot can be boiled down to a young person or a group of young people face an ancient evil thing and either defeat it or are defeated by it. And so I really do think that horror films are showing kids a way into the adult world. And I'm sure you've done exactly the same thing I have. You've talked to so many people who tell you about when they first saw Night of the Living Dead, when they were in, say, you know, the rec room of their friend's house and a group of kids were over there. There's a real bonding experience with horror films more than most other kinds of movies for teenaged audiences. And it seems to repeat generation to generation, and that's what I'm really hoping with this book, that the kids who really only know the things that have come out in, say, the past 5 years will go to the book and look at it and find out that there are really good things from decades past that are worth their time and effort to see, and when they watch them, they will see how those movies influence the things that they think are so cool right now.
You know, it's interesting you bring up Night of the Living Dead, because on this episode we're talking about George A. Romero's Martin, which to me is a film that kind of gets overlooked because it's between the two big twin towers of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. So when we talk about Martin, do you remember what your take on it was when you first saw it?
Yeah, I remember I had seen, as you said, Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, and kind of knew what Romero was up to, and I had heard about Martin, but had not seen it until I got that video store around the corner that had a good horror section, and that was the first time I was able to see it, and I was just knocked out by it because it was so different from the Living Dead movies, and yet was very much a part of the whole horror vampire mythos, and did something that I had never seen another horror movie do, in that it treated things so realistically. And I really do think, I'm not going to say it's Romero's best film, but it is a very, very good film, and one that his fans have to see. It's kind of required viewing for anybody who really wants to know what Romero's up to.
And what is it about the film? Like, when we talk about it, I mean, I know structurally it's a little different than what we're used to seeing in the Dead films. It's obviously a vampire story, but it's kind of an ambiguous vampire story, too.
Very much, because the whole idea of it, and are we trying to avoid spoilers here or not?
well, we let people know that we'll probably get into that area, but I figure it's a, you know, almost a 40-year-old film.
Right, and it is about a young man who thinks he is a vampire, and he has an uncle who thinks he's a vampire, and he uses drugs and razor blades to kill his victims. So whether there's anything supernatural happening or not is really kind of immaterial. It is, the film describes the world that he lives in, and really shows it to you in a very concrete way. I think in a way that films today, with their over-reliance on special effects, simply can't do anymore. I mean, Martin lives in the real world of suburban houses and downtown apartments and places that you don't see in movies these days. It seems completely real, and I've always thought that that is one of the prime things that a good horror movie has to do. It has to show you a world that you believe in, whether it is, you know, the world that Martin lives in or the world of Alien, that spaceship and that planet. You've got to believe those before you can believe the horror that's happening around it. And then Martin kind of works through what he's doing and how that is resolved. When I think of the movie, I always go back to that long sequence kind of in the middle, a stalking sequence is the only word that I can think of for it, that just drags you in and gets you so involved in it in a really visceral level, that it's the kind of thing you don't see in very many horror movies, many movies of any kind at all, really, that just make it seem so real while it's happening. That's the mark of a great filmmaker.
And I think that, you know, when we talk about the performances in it, I think it's quite good, too. I mean, the young man, John Amplis, who plays Martin, does such a great job. And the cast is really interesting because this is, I mean, as horror film fans go on, we become very familiar with the work of Tom Savini. But Tom Savini not only did makeup in here, but he's also an actor, and he's very good.
Yes, he is. And he's, I think he's a bit underrated as an actor. I mean, he's mostly been in small parts, but he tends to do really good work. And I've always kind of assumed that he's hired for that because he's got kind of an interesting face, and they bring him on to do the makeup and special effects stuff so they can kind of get him cheap as an actor. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I always kind of like it when you look in the corner of a scene and you see Tom Savini there, you know that something's going on right.
The thing with Martin is, and I don't know how many versions of Martin you've seen. I mean, it's my understanding that there's possibly two, maybe three different versions of the film. There was like a Romero director's cut. Do you know sort of which versions you've seen or which versions have been out there that you've people
know? No, I have only seen the what I thought was the complete version on VHS tape. And when I was working on the DVD book, I took a look at the DVD simply to judge image and sound quality, but I don't think I really saw the whole thing. So I don't know if there are any important plot details that I've missed. Do you know what they are? Is the ending changed?
Well, I know we're going to do some research into it, but I don't think it's that. I think it's more sort of in the middle of the film, you know, like extra plot threads and stuff like that. And I think I remember at one time, and I'm going to have to look this up, that there was a thing with One version, you know, because it flips back and forth from the version I remember seeing. I haven't seen it yet to get a chance to look at it, but it flips back and forth between the black and white and the color.
And I don't know about that.
Yeah. Romero's done zombies. Romero's done vampires. And to be honest, zombies and vampires have had a huge revival in probably the last 5 years.
Yes.
What is it that you think it is? And let's just talk about vampires for a second. Why do you think they keep popping up in our pop culture? What is it do you think vampires really say to us?
Vampires are sexy. I mean, and all of the big, very popular vampire things, it's really all about sex. I have to admit, I have not seen the thing on television, the Vampire Diaries, so I can't speak to that at all. This last horror movie book, I watched all of the Twilight series. Pity me. I had to do this. I cannot tell you that I did not fast forward. I did a lot. But to me, you take the Twilight series, it's a good example in the way that mainstream popular culture has now adapted so many of the really important themes of horror and turned them into the kind of entertainment for the masses. Words can barely express my loathing for the Twilight series. I just hate everything about them. But saying that, I have to admit that I understand why they are so popular and what's going on with their appeal to a young female audience. And there must be some guys who get dragged along to this, too. But their whole take on the whole vampire werewolf thing is so at odds with what real horror fans expect from that. For comparative purposes, I may be getting a little bit off topic here, but consider what was done with 30 Days of Night in working with vampires, taking the whole idea of vampires and doing something different with them. To me, that's just a brilliant film that surprised me, that scared me, that really challenged me and kept me interested all the way through in just the same way that Martin did. It's a very different kind of film. I'm not saying that they're the same at all, but I think both of them really are working within the school of horror and trying to really do something that the audience hasn't seen before. And it assumes both films, I think, assume that their audience understands what the vampire is and that this is going to be something very different about it.
You know, the thing that's interesting is when people brought up Twilight to me, I would often say to them, you know, you should see Let the Right One In.
Yes, yes. A wonderful movie. I really like it so much more than the American remake, which is a nice film. It's got a lot of things going for it. But Let the Right One In is just, again, a beautiful movie, haunting in all the right ways. I would put that right up there with it would make my top five vampire films easily.
The other one that we're going to talk about is Near Dark. And it's funny that you talk about Twilight a bit. And to me, sort of Near Dark could be a film that I think Twilight fans who get a little bit older might actually like, because there is that romance element in there.
Yeah, that's part of it. And it is, in many ways, a more mainstream film than a lot of the others we've been talking about. I think, for example, Martin would never be a mainstream hit because it is so quirky, so individual. It's made on a low budget. It looks like a 70s movie, and I mean that as a compliment. It's grainy, it's rough, all the things that the really good movies of the 70s were. But I think that's always going to keep it from finding that really big audience. The Twilight movies, you know, have all of the really big special effects, but they still manage to look kind of stupid in some ways, with the sparkly guy and the CGI werewolves, which just never worked at all for me. Martin is a movie that works completely without special effects. It was made in an era before we had all of the things that we can do now, and it doesn't need them because it's about the character and who he is and what he does. You don't need to have all of the crazy stuff going on around him for that to work. You've got to understand him, and by the end of that movie, you do to a degree, as much as Romero wants you to.
Do you think that, you know, we can sit here and bemoan Twilight for hours, but do you think that in a way, and I'm going to throw a weird analogy out there, I had a friend of mine who used to talk about how he got into heavy metal music, and he said that he started listening to like hair metal, pop metal in the 80s, and then a few years later he's like, what's this Metallica? What's this Slayer? And then all of a sudden he's gone from Poison to listening to Slayer. Do you think that someone can ramp up from being a Twilight fan to going, you know, what's this other vampire story over here? And then they become more interested in things that are far more interesting, like you were talking about Martin, than what Twilight was offering them a few years before.
Oh, very much. Yeah. And don't you think that's part of the particularly when you're a young viewer and you're starting to discover things, you're sort of trapped by the culture that you live in. If, say, you are 14, 15 years old now, you sort of have to see the Twilight movies first. They're right in front of you. You see the advertisements all over the TV and the net and everywhere else, and all of your friends are seeing them, so you have to too. And if you understand what the real appeal is there, then you're going to gravitate to the other things. I think you're going to figure out the horror that really does speak to you in a more serious way. Let's put it that way. And okay, I have said very negative things, and I think very negative things about the Twilight movies, but I do understand why they appeal to their target audience. And I am not one to argue with success. Stephanie Myers did something that really works, that touches people. And so I'm not going to just go crazy over it, because it, as you say, it will lead some fans to other things that will take them to different places, and they will be better for it, I think.
We're back. Thanks to Mike Mayo for taking time out to talk to me, and we'll have links to some of Mike's books over at our website, projection-booth.com. Now, back into the discussion on Martin, and this is one thing I wanted to talk about, Mike, is, you know, we did Love and Death with Keith Gordon about a month or two back, and we were talking about how Love and Death kind of comes right in the middle between sort of like two really big Woody Allen films and kind of gets overshadowed. So do you sort of feel the same with Martin, that when we look at sort of George A. Romero's entire filmography, and specifically in the 70s in this time, that Martin is sort of overlooked, like people don't really know it's there?
I'll say that people definitely know Dawn of the Dead a lot more, and definitely Night of the Living Dead. But I have to say, when we did an episode early on, we did a special episode on Fright Night, and Bill Byforce was on there, Mondo Justin, myself, and we did our top five vampire movies. And we actually got called out quite a few times because Martin wasn't on the list. None of us mentioned Martin whatsoever. And we had, you know, for our show that barely ever gets any feedback, that we actually had like three or four comments of people saying, well, what about Martin? Martin's the best vampire movie. Where is this movie on there? So it's like, oh, okay. So it was kind of a nice coincidence when you said, oh, we should do Martin. It's like, okay, yeah, I've been meaning to watch this, as I mentioned before, having the VHS tape forever. And, you know, when all these people were like, oh, what about Martin? It's like, all right, yeah, let's check it out. And yeah, I don't know if I would put this in my top five favorite vampire films, but it was definitely a very interesting take on it. What do you think, Ed?
People who are really into vampire films know this, and that's it. You know, I think the casual vampire film person hasn't even heard of it, because it has been scarce to, you know, the accessibility of it has been scarce too. So, I mean, that helps. But yeah, it's offbeat and it's weird. I mean, the reactions I've gotten from, you know, students are, it makes them uncomfortable. That's always going to affect, you know, how popular, how well-known a movie becomes. But I even think, you know, a movie like Near Dark, which I assume everyone knows about, I find that people who are younger, in even up into their 20s, have never heard of even Near Dark. So I think, you know, these smaller vampire movies really get nudged out of the limelight over time. And unless you're talking about them on a show like this and telling people about them, they do get forgotten.
Well, it's funny you bring up Near Dark, because we will be talking about that very soon.
My two favorite vampire movies, Martin and Near Dark.
But for me also, it seems that, you know, my reason for bringing this up is that, of course, you have sort of the twin towers of, you know, the kind of cast shadows over the 70s when it comes to Romero. It's, Night of the Living Dead is late 60s, but sort of that 10-year period in there between the two zombie films, and then, of course, all the zombie films afterward, everybody knows Romero for zombies. I mean, the casual fans, obviously. But it just sort of seems like nobody bothers to go back and investigate those mid-70s films. And it didn't seem like anyone knew what the hell the crazies were or was until the damn remake was made. So it's like, you know, unless somebody does a remake of Martin, I don't know if mainstream understanding of the film is going to come about.
I've heard rumors of a remake of this more than once. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, it'll be good or it won't be. I mean, he's got that whole period where, you know, in between his first two zombie films, he wasn't making any money. Nobody went to see his films. So Martin was, you know, I think the terrible box office. But, all of them until Dawn of the Dead.
But there's a lot of good stuff in there. I mean, if you go back and you see Season of the Witch, you see The Crazies, those right there stand up really well. Martin, of course. So, I mean, you have like two or three really great films in between that don't really get a lot of attention unless you're like a huge cult guy.
Even between like Day of the Dead and Land of the Dead, you know, I've talked about Two Evil Eyes on here as being one of the movies that really turned me off of Argento. And, you know, it really didn't do much to help me with Romero either. And having like Monkey Shines and The Dark Half and Bruiser in between there. I haven't seen Bruiser yet, so I don't know if that one's like this hidden gem or something. But I know Monkey Shines, I was not that impressed with it, or with The Dark Half. So it's like he has these signposts throughout his career, and unfortunately almost all of them have zombies on them. And it's like, yeah, between Dawn and Night, there were some great things going on in between there, and between Dawn and Day, there were some great things going on in between there, but between Day and Land, it's just like, yeah, not really hitting on all cylinders with those.
And I wonder if that's just by virtue of the fact of where producers are coming in. If you could have George Romero doing a zombie film for you, you would give him the money to do it. But if you're going to have him do anything else, maybe you're like, here's something, but whatever.
Yeah, I'm just impressed that he was able to do things like Knight Riders. Creepshow just seems like a natural for him. And that one just, it has such a different look and feel to it. And just that, you know, whole comic book aesthetic that he's doing. I mean, just as it's a gorgeous film, and I love to go back to it. And every Father's Day, I always think about that film. So, you know, such great stuff going on in it. Now it does seem like nobody would necessarily be bankrolling any of his projects unless they had Of the Dead in the title.
You know, the thing that's funny is you talk about between Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead, which of course is Knight Riders, is in the middle of that. And Knight Riders is overlooked. Now, for me, the last time I saw it, and I'll admit it was 15 years ago, I thought, once again, it suffers from being a little too long. I think it's 2.5 hours, but it's really interesting and it's really well done. And if you're a fan of someone like Ed Harris, who's gone on to be, you know, Mondo famous, have a good career, it's interesting to go back and watch Knight Riders just to sort of see Ed Harris as he was starting out.
And you can see this, then there's a Stephen King cameo, you know, because, yeah, I mean, it's when Romero hooked up with King at this period. I think that he's far less interesting a filmmaker nowadays, although I haven't seen Bruiser either, and that has been recommended to me as interesting. I think he had his, he's made his best films, I think. I'm not sure that we're going to get another great one out of him.
I think he got the best performance that Stephen King has ever given on film.
Oh, you done it now, Jordy Verrill, you monkhead.
You know, the thing that's funny, and Ed, you brought this up, showing this movie to 19, 20-year-olds who obviously would know Twilight. You talked about Twilight in the beginning. What has been the reaction from kids you may have in your class who are like, saw Twilight, they see this, and they go, aha, it's not vampires?
It's hard to get a gauge on them with Twilight, because even if they like Twilight, especially if they're guys, they're not going to admit it. So it's always, that's like the everyone's favorite, you know, whipping boy movie, you know, is Twilight now. And I don't like the film very much, but I always show scenes from Twilight in these classes because
actually, there's something interesting going on about vampires in those movies, but even though I hate them. I think it's the way films are made now, the kind of much more, you know, flashy aesthetic, and when they watch a gritty, you know, almost documentary-looking film like Martin with his very naturalistic acting style, that's the kind of thing that I think turns them off more than, you know, the story or what it's about. They don't like the color of the blood. You know, they really notice all these little details now because their whole movie experience growing up is so different than, you know, the previous generations in watching films. They expect everything to look perfect. And clearly, 70s movies don't look perfect, and nor do I want them to. And I think they have a harder time getting over that hump than they have over the actual storyline. That seemed to be the way conversation was always going when I covered Martin in the last. I've only done it once in class. When I covered it last semester, I almost had a hard time getting them to talk about it being a vampire film. Like, they didn't want to accept me. No, that's it. I think that they didn't accept it as a vampire film. That it's just a killer film. It's just a guy who's crazy who, you know, cuts people with razor blades and drinks their blood and he's nuts. So, and it doesn't look as good as Seven.
The one thing that when I was talking about the difference between the script and the film, the one thing that is really missing from it is the sex. I mean, we don't necessarily see Martin having sex with the woman. There is that in the script. And when Martin does what he does with the women, there's a lot of sex to it. I mean, there is a very large sexual component, especially with the first murder, where he's basically covering his body in blood while he's having sex with the woman on the train. And they really shy away from that. I mean, they cut all that stuff out in the film. I don't know if Romero even shot it, but yeah, it is very much more of just blood than it is about the sexual part to it. And even though Martin does talk about doing the sexy stuff quite often, but yeah, it's interesting that they kind of got away from there, whereas there's so much of that tie-in between sex and death and blood and all that, and as part of the whole overarching vampire lore.
That just goes back to what we talk about with Stoker and all that and the Victorian, you know, mores in which that was created, with vampirism as a stand-in for sexuality to some extent when it was first sort of came onto the scene in pop culture.
I wonder, though, if he doesn't pull the sex out or make the sex seem less explicit in the film because, I don't know, especially in that first murder scene, when after Martin knocks the women out and he kind of curls up with them. Yeah, it's creepy, but it's also, I mean, he's so vulnerable and he's so childlike in those moments that I think if he's, you know, pounded away, covered in blood, I think you lose the audience right away for him, for to feel any sympathy towards him, that he seems, you know, such a gross monster that you wouldn't, and that movie really depends upon, I think, you feeling sympathy and wanting, you know, him to kind of be okay. And I think that, you know, and I wonder if not, you know, in casting John Amplis and looking like such a boy in those scenes, and he's like 20, he's in mid-20s at least, he looks like he's 16 in the movie, but I wonder if it's not in actual filming as they begin to film that movie, if they don't pull back. Because you're right, it is in the script, and the novelization, it's like that too, and it's really explicit pound. I think pounding is actually in there, or something like that, as he's climax, and then he reaches a climax as he's covered in blood, and yeah, that would make it would have completely changed for me watching that character be introduced and then even playing out through the movie.
I think they were pretty smart too by removing his voiceover,
yeah,
and just leaving the discussion with the radio DJ as his kind of voiceover, which I found very smart, the way that they use that DJ as his kind of outlet to get some of his thoughts out. You know, we don't have that throughout the entire movie. So when he finally does start talking to that DJ, it's like, oh, now we kind of get a little bit more understanding of what is going on with Martin. It is his internal voice, you know, his confessional. So it's kind of a nice way that they do that. And especially, you know, you'd mentioned about towards the end when we're using that as a voiceover, we're not even sure that he's talking to the DJ at that point. And it's nice that kind of brings it back and all that to show us that he is on the phone, but then, you know, that he's playing that over the different scenes. I thought was very smart.
I want that white suit that Cuda has. Boy, I think I would look so great in that white suit that he wears.
You would look good with that, especially with the cane and everything. Kuda doesn't take any crap, man.
He doesn't. It's funny because he's so easy to hate, I think, for me through this film, until he kills Martin. And then I almost think that, hey, Kuda's right. I've been rooting for Martin all this movie, and Martin's going around killing all these women. And Kuda's just saved all these innocent women from being murdered by killing Martin. And I think it's another play on Romero's on the old vampire literature and film tropes, and that Kuda's the Van Helsing in this movie, and Van Helsing's a dick. it really comes through in this movie. Like, yeah, and I always get that sense reading Bram Stoker's Dracula too, that Van Helsing is such a jerk, and I would hate to have to work with him. Kuda's the same way, you know, just unbending. This is the way it is. But in his mind, in his world, that's the only way to deal with this kind of monster. And even if Martin's really not a vampire, Martin's still going around killing women. So he does need to be stopped. And it's those, you know, awful people in the world that have to stop him.
I'm always curious as far as what happens with the women afterwards. Like, because he keeps saying to the one woman, like, just go to sleep, just go to sleep, everything will be okay. So I have a feeling that, yeah, I was going to say, I have a feeling that he's lying to them. Because if they wake up, they're going to be able to recognize him and they go, oh, hey, it's the guy who came by the house and said he was a blind guy.
Yeah, he sets up the first woman as a suicide in the train. And it's weird. In the novel, he throws her body out the train window. That he's already picked a place out along the route that the train will take, so he disposes of her body and then cleans up the crime scene.
Yeah, he does seem a lot more careful in the screenplay.
And then the woman that he finds with the man kills the man instead, and he tells her, he says, I'm not going to kill you, don't worry, and he doesn't, because he doesn't have to. She's not going to tell anybody that there was a man in her house that she was having an affair with who has now disappeared. She's not going to say a word.
Very true. We're going to take another break and play a preview from next week's show.
Jimmy, give us some drinks here. Hiya, Ben, Nick. Been looking all over town for you.
Okay, how about yourself, Jack?
Got some trouble. Big trouble. Kansas City with Marianne. It's getting fat as a water rat. He owes us a lot, Nick. Close to a half a million. He's skimming his own cream and sticking Kansas right up my ass.
Yep.
I need you to straighten him out.
So what's the tab?
$50,000. Any way it cuts.
Hello, Jim. Anyway.
Hi.
Anyway.
That's right, friends. Make sure you rustle up some cattle, get a big old steak. We'll be talking about Prime Cut and all things Lee Marvin. We'll be joined by Duane Epstein with his new book, Lee Marvin, Point Blank. Now, before we head out, I want to thank this week's special guest, Edward G. Pettit. Now, Ed, what keeps you busy over there in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia?
Besides trying to raise my kids, I'm working on a Poe book about Edgar Allan Poe in Philadelphia, which will be out one day. And I'm actually writing a play right now, a Charles Dickens murder mystery, in which Oliver Twist has grown up and been murdered, and you have to find out who did it. And it'll be performed at the Ebenezer Maxwell Mansion in Philadelphia, Victoria Mansion in Philadelphia, come October. And that's my days, writing as much as I can, and then teaching at LaSalle at nights.
Yeah, and people can follow you on Twitter at Philly Poe Guy, right?
Yeah, Philly Poe Guy on Twitter, and you can find me online at edwardpettit.com.
Okay, and we'll be sure to have links for those over at our website, projection-booth.com. Thanks again for coming on and talking with us about Martin, and thanks to everybody for listening. Before we head out, I want to remind folks that we are asking people to call in for an upcoming show we're doing called VHS Extravaganza. So, did you work at a video store? Did you frequent one where there were strange people working? Do you have any good stories to tell? Or if you were working at one, did you have any odd customers or good stories to tell about being behind the desk? Do you still own a VHS rewinder? If so, give us a ring at 734-666-0800 and leave us your torrid tale.
And what is it, Mike?
It is free when you call from work.
That's right, sir. I'm gonna go get some more.
size comparison.
Connor, you there, man?